morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day it might be. Welcome to the Leadership Connection. I'm Doug Plucknett. Today I have a very special guest in Robert Bob Latino. I've known Bob for a number of years. I'm trying to think, it's got to be 25 years anyway. I met him way back in my Kodak days. In fact, the whole family. I can't remember how many of you were involved in teaching the course back then, but I know Mark was there, and you had a sister that worked there. Your dad was still there. Five altogether, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Ken was working on ProAct at the time, developing that. So I've known the Latino family a number of years. We've been out in, at different conferences, had chicken wings together, and I'm not allowed to have those anymore either.
I believe that was Denver. Do you remember being in Denver together?
Yes, absolutely.
At one of those conferences.
Yeah. And so anyway, Bob is a great guy to have on here because he has been around in our industry for a number of years and understands leadership and the importance of leadership, especially in the reliability community and trying to get things done. So, Bob, if you could tell us a little bit about your background, for those leaders who have or people that are listening that might not know who you are.
Well, you can tell, Doug, that we've been around a long time because we knew each other when our hair was its original color. So it was about 25 plus years. Probably put on a few LBs over the years ourselves. My background, it's pretty well known in the sense that I started in reliability as a result of my father's influence in the reliability community. He had actually, in 1972, had set up a corporate research and development global department for a company at the time called Allied Chemical Corporation, which eventually purchased Honeywell and became Honeywell over the years. But if you can imagine, his research focused on equipment, process, and human reliability. And think of that, that's 50 years ago. Think if you're having trouble today, think about what it was 50 years ago when nobody could spell reliability and had no idea what it was. And then trying to, I still remember him talking about conversations about where does it go on the organizational chart in the, from the corporate standpoint, and trying to make it subordinate to maintenance. And he says, you're missing the whole point. He says, maintenance is a today function. Reliability is a tomorrow function. If you make me subordinate to maintenance, we'll never get any reliability or opportunities done. So it's an interesting conversation to have 50 years ago about reliability and its purpose into an organization. But he set up that department worldwide. And then 1985, he ended up retiring. He got his magical 80 points, age plus years of service, and he bought his group out of the corporation, and Reliability Center Incorporated was born instead of just being Allied's Reliability Center. I spent a couple years working in a reliability department. My specialty was infrared at the time. I laugh now when you can get a little attachment on your phone now from the FLIR. It's like $200 and you can run around. And I had to carry around a 100-pound AGA 782 with the liquid nitrogen, carrying all that around. Now I can do it on my phone. And then I joined the company in 1985 when we became independent. I have served in the capacity of, we're a reliability engineering firm specializing in those specific areas, training, consulting, and of course the software side of the RCA investigation software called ProAct. And I guess I've been a practitioner, and I continue to this day to be a practitioner. I've got quite a few books in the healthcare and the industrial side on these topics of reliability and RCA. And I guess what may not be as well known is that in 2019, due to succession planning and my five brothers and sisters, some of us aging out, that we enacted succession planning. We sold the business in 2019. Some retired. I stayed on for about a year and a half for transitionary purposes. And today, I just me and Kenny had a company called well, it was him called Prelical Solutions LLC. And he gets a lot of flack for that name because everybody says, what the hell does Prelical mean? And our standard answer is, well, that's the combination of a low marketing budget and alcohol. Is that that's supposed to be the merging? It's supposed to be the merging of the words practical and reliability, but I still yet to see how that comes together. So me and Ken are just like you said, you know, with your career at this point, we just want to we want to share our mistakes so that other people don't have the same ones. We just want to have fun working with people that we like to work with. So that's where we're at.
That's the magical part of being semi-retired. You get to work with those you like to work with.
Yeah. we have choices now. We're not as.
I think one of the other things that always sticks in my mind about your family was one of you, and I'm not sure which it was smart enough that when the .coms came out, you got reliability.com. And I know that was a word that everybody was hoping to get at the time. I myself, when I did reliabilitysolutions.com, got the same type of thing. Reliability Solutions Incorporated. I had John Schultz call me and say, "You son of a gun!" I was just trying to do that, and somebody said, "No, it's already been grabbed."
Well, I'll have to give Kenny the credit for that one. I mean, his background was computer science, and he foresaw that coming, and we couldn't believe that it was open. But I can say from the acquisition standpoint that that played in as an asset to have the reliability.com.
Very good. So looking back on your career, what are some of the things that motivated you to be a leader? I mean, you said you started out, you know, going out and doing the IR stuff, and then somehow you end up evolving into being a leader out there in this community.
Well, you know, a lot of that, that could be another book that I could write about the highs and lows of being a family business, is that, you know, my answer to that, with all honesty, would be the fact that I didn't choose to be a leader, is that I was put into a position because of my business background, that when my father passed, that I took over the business. And, you know, from a leadership standpoint, you know, understanding the back end, the front end, and, you know, I had the front end experience. I didn't have the back end experience. But when you're thrown in a position like that, you have a new respect for the fact of, you know, everybody who works for you, their lives and their livelihoods are based on your leadership skills and giving them the latitude to be successful in their personal lives. So, you know, a lot of that, my father used to use the term about unleashing the creativity of the workforce. And that's, you know, how he was a motivator from the bottom up versus the top down. He said, if you pave the way for the field to trust you for one, he said, they have all the answers you need. He said, you just got to give them the latitude to let you know that. And so that was a lot about unleashing that creativity that was the focus of his reliability efforts.
Very good. As a leader, what are your thoughts on the changing companies, you know, when they look at how are we going to get from being reactive to proactive? What are some of the places they could start? What are some of the things you think they ought to be doing to make that transition?
Well, you know, obviously, that was another thing in these old, this is going down memory lane for me, but when my father was starting the reliability group there, you know, they hardly had any resources or resourcing. And the reason was there were so many people fixing things. And so, you know, you recognize the need that as soon as I'm able to alleviate the need for so many fixers, I can move them over to more creative jobs rather than just becoming good at fixing things. You know, and they get pats on the back where you used to take 4 hours to fix. Now it takes 2 hours to fix. and then moving them over to creative jobs where you can do root cause analysis, you can do all the NDT testing, you can do all of the proactive activities that have a little bit more spice to them than fixing the same thing over because you feel that nobody cares. So I think that a lot of that, it's a mental game. It's a cultural game, is that you have to demonstrate through actions and not just talk that, we have a vision that we want to be here in a year. And that involves reducing the stress in your life, not being called in on nights and weekends all the time, but being able to predict and prevent these things. And we called it controlling the fix and not letting the fix control us. So that was really defined what reliability was. But it's a, you know, one thing I found, and you probably the same way, Doug, is that I'm not really sure how to explain it, but it's like, if you're a career reliability professional, you're a frustrated individual, and people who live around you are frustrated with you, because we live through a prism of proaction, and then we look around and we say, why doesn't everybody else see this? Why can't they foresee that this thing was going to fail? Why is this such a shock to people when we have unexpected things happen? And, we're the type of people that, buy warranties for everything in your house. And then, you're giving the guy at Lowe's a hard time because he doesn't know the specs on what you're buying. And, you have a PM program for your house. You know, we're those kind of people. And, the kind of people where your spouse is embarrassed to go out with you because of how many questions you're going to ask. And, we're terrible. I'm a terrible patient, having spent 20 years doing RCA in a hospital. I'm a pain in the butt for being a patient, because I'm going to question you to death, and you can have any kind of credentials that you want. I'm not going to be impressed with that, because nobody cares more about my health than me.
Right. So one of the things I could say that I learned from you and your dad and your family was some of the simple things, right? The use of Pareto analysis to be able to go out and look at the things that are eating your lunch and you're not recognizing you because they take sometimes 20 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes. Not a big deal, right?
Yeah.
Until you look at that and you start adding it up. There's one job that I can always relate to. It wasn't that difficult. It was the, climbing the, let's see, I could get going through my head, 5 flights of stairs, with a good size filter for this system to replace it that was plugging once a week. And the filter itself was $500, right? So add that up over a year and it starts to get significant. And then you put the hourly rate on top of it, right? And you go, what's going on here? And it was just one of the things that I put a couple guys together to say, okay, we've got 3 systems like this, and this is the only one that plugs. What's the difference between it and the other two? Right. And that's because process of elimination, we solved that. And then the next thing, you got people opening their eyes going, wait a minute, what can it really be that easy? Right. And it is. And those are the things that people forget about. They want to use fancy tools and they want to talk fancy language, and it really comes down to what's eating our lunch, right? What's doing it over and over again? What are some of those things that are a pain in the neck?
Well, and those are, that process we used was called opportunity analysis, and it's taken a Pareto cut. The equation is like you say, it's really simple. It's frequency per year that it happens times impact per occurrence, which is basically downtime cost, man hours, and materials. If you aggregate that up for, the kicker in that is the frequency per year, because on its individual occurrence, nobody cares. It's the cost of doing business. And like you said, putting it in the CMMS takes more time than actually fixing it. But when that simple thing is happening 1,000 times a year, throughout the facility, well, now you'll get the CFO's attention. But on its individual impact, it's not going to get their attention, because all you do is get better at fixing it. It's no longer a failure. It's part of the job.
Right. So let me ask you, you've been around a number of years. Are there any books or courses that you've taken in your time that you think would be something that people really ought to take a look at?
Well, this is going to be a tried and true answer to that, and I know that you're familiar with it too, but one course, if you call it that, that I went through that impacted me for my life was the manufacturing game, and Winston Lee's manufacturing game, because that has all sorts of aha moments in it for the first time you played that, and you're put in a position that you're not in in your organization, but that really puts the role of reliability into perspective. And their defect elimination strategy, it gets back to when you were talking about proaction and reaction. And even though the back end of the manufacturing game influences what they coined as defect elimination, that Winston from Michelle's father and the author of Don't Just Fix It, Improve It. You know, when you're using defect elimination and people, I'm not a five whys fan for complex events. I'm not saying, right. I don't think it's an RCA tool myself, but it does serve great value when you're doing things like the manufacturing game and you're coming up and you just want people to identify barriers as individuals to their ability to be successful in their job. So you want them to peel the onion more than the obvious and just failure and response. You want them to have some analytical depth to thinking through, what's actually triggering this? So, but what they're doing on those, because those typically aren't in your CMMS systems, those are all those proactive things. Maybe it's late in life and I'm not that smart, but, I've spent a career dealing with high magnitude, high visibility failures where you have deaths and you have $1 million losses and things like that. And, you go through this comprehensive RCA and evidence gathering and you come to these conclusions that, all of these system deficiencies, we found all these system deficiencies, but we had to go through all that effort to figure that out. When if you just asked all the operators and mechanics, they know that. They know all that stuff is there. It's just that they're not going to tell you anymore because you don't do anything about it. So, that bottom-up approach of getting the field to tell you the things that are from a system standpoint that they have to develop workarounds on, that's the proactive portion. You don't have to wait for the failure. Stop those things, fill in those holes that are deficiencies in organizational systems, and then prevent them from becoming part of the failure.
Yeah. Interesting enough, Bob, in my book, I've read a little story about a chat that I had with my son one evening after I started my business and was traveling quite a bit. And he's asking me about what I do. And I had been working out on an oil platform and flying back and forth on a helicopter. So he was about 14, 15 at the time, And so he asked me what I do, and I said to him, well, I go out there and I ask people, we talk about a system that's they're having struggles with and how it's supposed to operate and what currently the failures they're having with it. And then I put the information in my database and then ask him a series of questions. And then we come up with a task to mitigate those things. And he's just kind of looking at me and he says, so their people know the answer? And I said, yeah. He says, Dad, how long do you think this is going to last?
Right.
I said to him, forever. Because it's strange that people don't know enough to ask their own people, what are our problems and what do we got to do to get rid of them? Right.
Well, that's what I tell my clients now that I'm on my own is that, when you don't need me anymore is when I've been successful. Is because my job is to transfer it, not to create a dependency on me, but my job is to make sure that the skills transfer to your people so that they say, well, why are we paying this guy? It's time to move on.
And to tell the truth, whether you'll like it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes the truth is painful, right?
Well, yeah, and I got a paper or two on that too, about the success in the failure business. Is really predicated on the fact of management and leadership being able to look in the mirror and say, I'm part of the problem.
Yeah.
So that's a big. You're not going to make any progress if their only purpose is to attack the integrity of the evidence that you bring. Because if they're not willing to say I'm part of the problem, then you're probably not going to make a lot of progress anyway. They're probably what I call. I had a slide made up for Mark when he retired, and it was a tombstone that said R.I.P. And like the year before, when you know you're going to retire, I call that retired in place. You're just coasting until you're not rocking the boat. You're not doing anything.
So if you were forced to pick one way or another, looking at leadership, is that a learned skill or is it a natural skill, you think?
At least in my experience, I'd have to say it's a learned skill, because I don't think I was born with it. I think I was exposed to it and then forced to it and then refined it. Uh-huh. So, you know, my this is a plug for the military in general, but I think you probably have interviewed a lot of my friends from the Coast Guard, Hank and Charlie Marino, Tom Moriarty, Hank Kosifer, and Ron Butcher. When you look at any of my friends that are in the military and the discipline of leadership on that, it really is a model. It should be a model for the rest of us. I know it's a completely different atmosphere, but, it is a system. And you have to understand the organizational system as from the standpoint of inputs, transformations, and outputs. But I've just always been impressed with all of my military friends and the training that the U.S. military has had.
Likewise, I speak quite a bit with Ron Moore, and he uses a 10-point slide of Colin Powell's on leadership, and it's pretty comprehensive, and it is one of those things that what I tell people, if you're thrown into that role, you're going to find out that it's very uncomfortable at first. I do believe that there are some folks that have a tendency for natural leadership skills. I have an older brother that was like that, didn't matter what he was doing. He was a guy that's going to take that leadership role. He's just seemed to have it naturally. However, right, you still have places to grow, things to learn, because sometimes those skills that you learn early on are the wrong way too. Right. And that's one of the things that Ron talks about is, when you come out of the military and you've been used to, you're going to do this and away they go. And you come into a society where you say, you're going to do this. And people go, why? Why do I gotta?
Yeah.
All right. There's a place where all of a sudden you got to say, ooh, I might need to learn something here, because that influence that I had before based on rank is no longer there.
Right? Yeah. It was interesting. I was, I forgot where, but it was a smeltering mill, aluminum somewhere. And I was having beers with that night with one of the guys who was just hired he'd been there about a month, but he was an Air Force pilot. after about 3 or 4 beers in, when the candor started coming out, I said, you're never going to make it here. I said, you have way too much discipline in your background to put up with 100-year-old mill and the culture that goes along with, generational mills that I know you've been a part of. And sure enough, he didn't last 3 months after that. He couldn't take the lack of discipline in the organization.
And really, reliability demands it. And that's one of the things, especially in the world of maintenance. If you don't have the discipline to do things when they're supposed to be done, you're going to struggle.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Well, Bob, I'm going to tell you in closing today, it's been a pleasure talking to you and seeing your smiling face.
Well, that's usually a penalty for most people, but thank you, Doug. And I hope you're feeling better.
Yeah, I'm sure this is going to pass within a couple of days, and life will go back to normal. And let's just hope this whole thing at some point becomes nothing more than a common cold.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, tell the rest of the family I said hello, especially Ken and Mark. Those are the ones that I know and communicated with once in a while. So, and are you still doing any conference type stuff at all or no?
No, I'm actually on the board of an organization now called the Community of Human and Organizational Learning. And that's like a human performance type of conference, resilience, reliability. And I'm still going to SMRP on the national conference level. Right. That was really fun last year when we went back to, I think it was St. Louis, and I hooked up with the Marinos and the Moriartys, and that's where I see all the old friends, and that's where all the I call alcohol the mortar between the bricks. That's where all the work gets done, Doug. All the deals are made.
All right, Bob. It's been great talking with you.
Same here.
This is Doug Plucknett for the Leadership Connection. Have a great day and tune in again. Bye-bye.